fire, eventually getting it down to 100 seconds. One night they were able to hit back in just that amount of time, and the next day a patrol found a 60-millimeter mortar tube on the far bank of the Euphrates and three dead men at a nearby hospital. Swanick appeared almost incredulous at the inability of Karpinski's troops to respond in a similar fashion, she recalled in an interview. "What do you have for force protection?" he asked. "An armored division that doesn't want to help me," she said, referring to the 1st AD, which operated just to her east, in and around Baghdad. He was also stunned that her sentries did not respond to hostile fire from the villages adjacent to the prison, nor did they conduct patrols through those areas. That amounted to an invitation to the insurgents to launch attacks. Swanick looked at Karpinski. She remembered him slapping her on the back and saying, "Well, Sanchez really fucked you." He got into his Black Hawk and flew off. But that night, he made sure that a mortar platoon from the 82nd was on her western flank, and 2 days later, he assigned an infantry company to patrol in that area to keep insurgents away from the prison. In December, at the next monthly meeting of commanding generals in Iraq, Karpinski recalled she confronted Odierno. "Look, sir, your mobile interrogation teams need to do a better job, and not keep dumping thousands of unscreened Iraqis on her facility." "I don't have the fucking time to do it," Odierno responded dismissively. "Tell Wojtkowski to get you more facilities," referring to Sanchez's deputy, Major General Walter Wojtkowski, who handled a lot of dull but important issues, such as logistics and other support functions. Odierno's riposte was a classic combat commander's response, and captures the unequal nature of the exchange. He was an active-duty two-star general, the commander of an armored division, one of the Army's premier units. He was the youngest division commander in the Army, and he was physically imposing, 6'5" tall and weighing 250 pounds, with a bullet-like shaved head. Everyone around him knew he was destined for 3 or 4 stars and might be chief of staff of the Army one day. She was smaller, a woman, a reservist one-star general, the commander of support troops. In Army terms, that meant her job was to solve his problems, not add to them. But Karpinski stuck to her guns, according to her account. In a previous confrontation, she'd found that if she weathered his initial blustery response, she could get through to him. She told him that the torrent of detainees, many of them shipped by his outfit, was swamping her operation at Abu Ghraib. Odierno relented a bit. "Tell me more," he said. "What kind of numbers would you like?" She said she needed more discrimination in who was shipped to her. He said he would look into it, and he did, she said in 2005. But they, Odierno's 4th ID, were still the worst offenders. On Christmas Day, she went out to Abu Ghraib to check on the state of the operation. The staff there told her, a bit chagrined, that they were over capacity, and just the night before had turned away a shipment of 7 prisoners sent down from northern Iraq by Petraeus's 101st Airborne Division. They actually had told the incoming flight to put the Iraqis back on the helicopter and take them away. That worried Karpinski. "I knew Petraeus wouldn't be happy," she recalled. So instead of waiting to be hauled in to explain what was going on, she went to see Wojtkowski. Standing 6'4" tall, Wojtkowski had played basketball at West Point under Bob Knight and had gone on to a career in which he specialized in infantry training. He told her not to worry about all the detainees coming in, she recounted. "He got angry. He put down his pen and looked her straight in the eye. 'I don't care if we're holding 15,000 innocent Iraqis. We're winning the war,' he told her," she later said in a sworn statement to Army investigators. "No, sir, you are not," she responded. "Not inside my wire you are not winning. You are making enemies. You're making enemies out of every one of those people you're holding without a reason. This isn't a fair carriage of justice. This isn't dignity and respect. This isn't the road ahead you are allegedly preaching all the time. This is smoke and mirrors, a facade of security in Baghdad. There is no such thing." Wojtkowski didn't respond to request for an interview. On January 12, Karpinski was on a mission near the Iranian border, sent there by General Sanchez, when she checked her email on the military's CIPRNet, its secure internal internet system. She saw one from the head of the Army's Criminal Investigation Division, its internal FBI. Curious, she opened it first and read two short sentences notifying her that her unit was being investigated for prisoner abuse. It isn't clear what had sparked that inquiry. The next day, Specialist Joseph Darby put photographs of the abuse occurring in Cell Block 1 Alpha into a plain envelope and slipped them under the door of their investigators. They looked at them, then accelerated their inquiry into hyperdrive. Just after midnight on January 14, Captain Donald Reese, the 39-year-old commander of one of Karpinski's subordinate units, the 372nd Military Police Company, was awakened and told that his battalion commander wanted to see him. After he had dressed and arrived at the unit headquarters, he was greeted by Chief Warrant Officer Second Class Paul Arthur, an official from the Army's CID. "We have to do an investigation on your soldiers," he was told, according to a statement he gave later. "We believe they're involved in some alleged abuse." 2 hours later, Reese, who in civilian life was a salesman from New Stanton, Pennsylvania, knocked on the door of Frederick, the sergeant who was chief of the night shift on 1 Alpha. "Freddy, CID is here and they want to talk to you," Reese said. Arthur and other CID agents seized Frederick's weapons and computer and interrogated him until 4 a.m. Frederick claimed in a statement that he had questioned some of the practices in the prison, but that the answer I got was, "This is how military intelligence wants it." A few days later, Karpinski met with Sanchez in his office at Camp Victory, the ornate set of palaces Saddam had built in a series of artificial lakes just east of Baghdad Airport. It was their second one-on-one meeting during her time in Iraq. It was a curt meeting, held at 9 at night, extremely late for officers whose days begin at dawn. "He was insulted by my presence. That's what he communicated to me," she recalled later, after consulting her daily journal. "Do you know what this is going to do to my army?" Sanchez said, she recalled. He issued a formal letter of admonishment to her. This established for the official army record that her performance was markedly below expectation. Karpinski wanted to offer some suggestions on how to handle the situation. It was a bad misreading of Sanchez's mood. "Sir, I've been in the Middle East for years, and I have a good relationship with the press here," she began. She offered to have a statement issued in Arabic that would put all this on my shoulders. She had even thought about how to release some of the digital images of torture. Her notion was to get out ahead of this mess. "We can choose a couple of photographs, and at least..." Sanchez cut her off, she recalled. "Absolutely not," he told her. "The Army wasn't going to let those photos out. There's not going to be any contact between you and the press," he added, according to notes she made in her journal that night. A series of official investigations ultimately would hang the criminal blame for Abu Ghraib on a group of low-ranking soldiers and the military responsibility on Brigadier General Karpinski. The military establishment was unsympathetic. She felt herself a victim, and she propagated a negativity that permeated throughout the brigade, Air Force Colonel Henry Nelson, a psychiatrist involved in the investigation, concluded. It was a tragic moment for a military with a long and proud heritage of treating its prisoners better than most, especially one that had come to Iraq thinking of itself as a liberation force, again, solidly in the American tradition. During the Revolutionary War, the historian David Hackett Fisher noted, General George Washington had often reminded his men that they were an army of liberty and freedom, and that the rights of humanity for which they were fighting should extend even to their enemies. This compassion toward prisoners was extended by Washington expressly in the face of the cruel British handling of American captives. Washington ordered Lieutenant Colonel Samuel Blakely Webb, in a passage quoted by Fisher, "Treat them with humanity, and let them have no reason to complain of our copying the brutal example of the British Army in their treatment of our unfortunate brethren." The United States Army was a long way from home in Iraq. Part 3. The Long Term. Chapter 13. The Army of the Euphrates Takes Stock. Winter 2003-4. In Iraq, the U.S. Army encountered two of its recent nightmares. The tactical opposition that developed was what it had feared it would find 7 years earlier in Bosnia. heavily armed factional fighters using AK-47s, rocket-propelled grenades, and landmines to attack U.S. troops, and then blending in with the population, frequently in urban environments. Meanwhile, its strategic position painfully resembled that of the Soviet Union in Afghanistan in the early 1980s, when the Red Army, after quickly taking the country, found itself mired and suffering increasing casualties. Ironically, when the U.S. military invaded Afghanistan 22 years after the Red Army, it was extremely conscious of the quagmire the Soviets had found there and took great pains to avoid replicating it. Instead of going in big and heavy and conventional, it went into Afghanistan fast, small, and innovative, combining soldiers on horses with B-52s in the air, using satellite signals from space to guide smart bombs to their unwitting targets. It was in Iraq that the Americans unconsciously repeated some of the Soviet errors in Afghanistan. They went in big, with lots of conventional forces and a tendency to rely on armored vehicles when possible. They confused swift entry with victory. They built big bases and reacted clumsily to insurgent attacks, using tactics that sometimes alienated the population. An army built to execute swift, crushing operations designed around heavy armor instead found itself enmeshed in a slow-moving, close-up war of small arms. It was a situation that defeated many of the technological advantages wielded by the U.S. military. After years of talking about its information superiority, the Army suddenly was in an inferior position. It didn't speak the language, it didn't understand the culture, it didn't know much about its enemy, and it seemed all too often to be the last one to know what was going on. One of the warning signs of attack, for example, was when a crowd of Iraqi civilians suddenly vanished. U.S. military bases and movements were easy to observe, while those of its enemy were largely unknown. The American military lacked a sufficient number of interpreters, but knew that some of those it did employ were in league with the enemy. It would be better if our working assumption was more modestly one of our own information inferiority, observed British Major General Bailey. As defense analyst Andrew Krupinovich put it, a world-class sprinter was being forced to run a marathon. By the end of 2003, the Army was recognizing that it was locked in its first protracted ground combat since the Vietnam War. As they prepared that winter to leave Iraq and turn over the mission to other units, in what would be one of the biggest troop rotations in the history of the U.S. military, the seasoned soldiers who had served there for a year sought to pass on their hard-won knowledge to their successors in emails, in essays, in PowerPoint presentations, and in rambling memoirs posted on websites or sent to rear detachments. It was an account far more personal than those offered by the media, and generally grimmer than the official statements that painted a picture of steady progress. Taken together, these gritty documents told the story of an unexpectedly hard, small war, punctuated by casualties that haunted the writers. At the same time, they showed how a well-trained, professional force, adjusted to complex ground combat in a harsh climate and alien culture, relearning some timeless lessons of warfare and discovering a few new ones. "We had to learn the hard way," Captain Daniel Morgan, an infantry company commander in the 101st Airborne Division, wrote in an essay that rocketed around military email circles. Morgan's essay was popular for two reasons. It was unusually well written, and it was relentlessly specific. One of the most striking lessons the 1992 graduate of Georgetown University passed on: every soldier in the unit should carry a tourniquet of sufficient length to cut off the gush of blood from major leg wounds. "Trust me," he wrote, "it saved four of my soldiers' lives." Morgan also emphasized to incoming soldiers that they needed to be ready to kill quickly, yet precisely. If an enemy opens fire with an AK-47 aimlessly, which most of these people do, you should be able to calmly place the red dot reticule of your M68 optic device on his chest and kill him with one shot, he admonished. "If you do this, the rest will run and probably not come back. And while patrolling, if you see an Iraqi notice you and then make a cellular phone call, change your planned route, and especially avoid the next major intersection where an ambush may be assembling." Like Morgan's, Many of the commentaries that were composed around this time had a tone of no-nonsense urgency. This was no longer a discreet, peacetime military that liked to pretend it could achieve zero defects. There was too much crap I saw over there that guys just don't understand, and it meant soldiers' lives, Captain John Rann, a 4th Infantry Division engineer, wrote in an essay that was posted on www.companycommand.com, which began as a private website by and for junior Army officers, but became sponsored by the Army and received an unusual kind of semi-official status. Much of what his soldiers were called upon to do were actions for which they hadn't been trained, Rand said. They will have to write a new book for this when it's all over. As a whole, the soldiers' commentaries tended to portray a harsh picture of Iraq and its people. Captain Ken Brager, a company commander in the 4th Infantry Division, headquartered in Tikrit, deep in the Sunni Triangle, stated that newcomers should understand that most of the people here want us dead. They hate us and everything we stand for, and will take any opportunity to cause us harm. 5 subjects dominated the new veterans' discussions: the innovative nature of the foe, the need to update tactics and equipment, ways to keep troops alert, and again, how to run a safe convoy. And then, less as a lesson than as a warning, there was the impact of casualties. The writers also repeatedly expressed a growing respect for their adversaries. The enemy is getting smarter, Brager wrote in his November 2003 essay. He watches us and makes adjustments accordingly. This new respect also surfaced in an official Marine summary that said, "The enemy is clever and should not be underestimated. Commanders that are ignoring or wishing away enemy capabilities and lethality are sustaining casualties." To a surprising degree, the lessons learned summaries focused on how to operate a military convoy safely. In 2003, highway overpasses became the Iraqi equivalent of ambush points on jungle trails during the Vietnam War. The developing wisdom was always to move toward them with caution, and then swerve from lane to lane at the last minute. Some studies also recommended that a gun truck, that is, a big vehicle with a mounted 50-caliber heavy machine gun, speed ahead of the convoy and train that gun on the bridge while the convoy passed under it. Captain Robert McCormick of the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment found that in eastern Baghdad, the vehicles that seemed to come under attack were that of soft skin and did not have any weapons noticeable or present. A more official military study warned that to be defensible, convoys should consist of at least 5 vehicles. The most vulnerable convoys were small ones of 3 or 4 vehicles, especially those in which rifles were not held visible and at the ready. Smaller convoys cannot produce enough firepower to fend off attacks or deal with casualties, it said. When possible, travel in large convoys, cautioned Major Eric Estep, who was based at the big supply depot at Balad, the destination of dozens of convoys every day. His PowerPoint presentation of a study of insurgent tactics against convoys also noted that they tended to attack the last vehicle. To counter this, he and others recommended putting heavy firepower there. The need for this aggressive posture was repeated often. It is true that the meaner and more prepared you look that you can return immediate fire, the more likely they'll think twice about attacking, wrote Rann. By contrast, Brager reported, some National Guard troops were so slovenly that they invited attack. We've noticed the convoys that get hit more often are ones with soldiers out of uniform. The guard guys usually travel in flak vest and t-shirt and do not pull security when they stop. A Marine summary of Army lessons noted that in the lead truck in a convoy, the driver and gunner tended to be too busy with their tasks to adequately scan the ground for roadside bombs. It recommended that a third soldier, equipped with binoculars and night vision goggles, be posted in that vehicle and be trained and ready to take over the machine gun should the gunner be hit. In another extraordinarily specific convoy lesson, Morgan trained his driver to take wide right turns in major intersections because, he explained, on turns, most IEDs, if not all, are placed on the inside turn. But several commanders warned in their reports that one thing worried them even more than roadside bombings or convoy attacks: complacency among their troops. Complacency is the number one killer of soldiers, reported Lieutenant Jessica Murphy, an MP officer. This is the one that bites most units. She said that even units being shot at can start treating missions as routine. To keep an edge, Captain Paul Evangelista, commander of an engineer company in the 10th Mountain Division, sought to make sure that all soldiers went on missions outside the base, that is, beyond the wire. Support troops, such as mechanics, cooks, and clerks, tended not to leave their bases, with some hardly going outside them during a one-year tour. The inevitability of casualties and the need to train for them was a recurring theme. Rand said that the image that would remain with him was watching a burly platoon sergeant cup the head of his wounded medic and quietly tell him that his left arm was gone. His grim message to the incoming troops, "It's real, and the cost is real. Guys get hurt, and guys die." There were worrisome signs of trouble in the U.S. military in Iraq in the fall and winter of 2003 through 4. During the fall, the Bush administration launched an anti-media campaign that argued that the situation was better than journalists were portraying it. Troop morale was good, President Bush said in early October, and life in Iraq is a lot better than you probably think. Just ask people who have been there. A few days later, Stars and Stripes, the military's own newspaper, did just that. The Pentagon-managed publication displayed unusual journalistic courage by coming back at the commander-in-chief with the results of its survey of U.S. troops then in Iraq, using its embedded reporters to distribute questionnaires to 1,935 troops at several dozen U.S. bases in Iraq. Stars and Stripes found that 49% of those responding described their unit's morale as low. Many soldiers also described their training as insufficient. A subsequent, more scientific survey by the Army's own experts from Walter Reed Hospital confirmed those findings. There was widespread unhappiness among soldiers in Iraq, especially in the National Guard and reserve units. In the Walter Reed survey, taken in the late summer and early fall of 2003, 72% of soldiers, both active duty and guard and reserve, reported that morale in their unit was low. Like Stars and Stripes, the Army showed true professionalism in having the intellectual honesty to release the data to the public, even if some of its most startling findings were tucked away deep in thick annexes to the report. The survey also found a surprising degree of unhappiness with battalion commanders, with nearly 75% of soldiers saying that leadership at that level was poor. This finding was a shock, because the Army doesn't give command of a battalion to inferior officers, especially in combat. A third survey of 1,200 deployed soldiers from the Illinois Army National Guard found that the majority of soldiers feel they are poorly informed, inadequately cared for, and that training in their units is boring and unorganized, according to a summary by Brigadier General Charles Fleming, the deputy commander of the Illinois Guard. Holshek was one battalion commander who experienced the disgruntlement with leaders firsthand. In September, not long after his battalion was told that its time in Iraq would be extended by several months, he reported to the Chief of Civil Affairs that the unit was in trouble. Mission end state uncertainty has seriously eroded morale. News of extension has exacerbated this, he wrote in a PowerPoint briefing for his superiors. Ability to maintain mission focus deteriorating. He reported that there had been 6 major disciplinary charges brought in the previous month. Holshek said later that he came to believe that the cause of the turmoil among the troops wasn't the quality of commanders, but rather the disconnect between what the Army was designed to do and what it actually found itself doing. I would say that the U.S. Army, 90%, was not structured for success, he said later. We've got a military designed to fight big wars, and it's constantly fighting small wars. So, he said, he found himself seen by subordinates as the representative of an institution that had failed its members. Where are our squad automatic weapons? Where is our body armor? How long are we going to be here? For months, he added, he had been unable to find out how much longer his unit would serve there. All we knew was that everyone was being extended, regardless. Nor could I get a straight answer from my chain on when we would leave Iraq. Until about less than 1 month before we left. Indeed, army morale improved sharply when soldiers began to receive clearer signals on the likely duration of their tours of duty. When army researchers returned a year later to conduct a similar survey, they found that 54% of the 2,064 soldiers surveyed reported poor morale. That still wasn't good, but it was an 18 percentage point improvement on the 2003 figure. The army wasn't broken, yet, but it was being stressed and strained in unexpected ways. No matter what ultimately happened in Iraq, it became clear that it was going to emerge from the war there a very different institution. Chapter 14. The Marine Corps Files a Dissent. Winter 2003-4. In the winter of 2003-4, the Marine Corps was ordered to head back to Iraq to lend a hand. Its units would replace the army in one of the toughest parts of the country, Al-Anbar Province in the western desert, a region dominated by the hostile towns of Fallujah and Ramadi. "Be polite, be professional, but have a plan to kill everybody you meet," was one of the rules to live by that Major General James Mattis gave his Marines. Mattis, the commander of the 1st Marine Division, began in the winter of 2003-4 to train his troops to operate differently from the army when they returned to Iraq. Mattis is unusual in many ways, most notably in being one of the more intense intellectuals in the U.S. military. "He is one of the most urbane and polished men I have ever known," said retired Army Major General Robert Scales, himself a Ph.D. in history. He can quote Homer as well as Sun Tzu. When he deploys, Mattis always packs the meditations of Marcus Aurelius, the Roman who was both a Stoic philosopher and an emperor. "It allows me to distance myself from the here and now, and to discern the connection to the eternal verities of warfare," he explained. Mattis also objected to the Rumsfeld Pentagon's emphasis on net-centric warfare built around the movement of data. "Computers by their nature are isolating. They build walls. The nature of war is immutable. You need trust and connection." He dismissed the net-centric emphasis as a Marxian view. It ignores the spiritual. With his troops, he tended to be earthier. "The first time you blow someone away is not an insignificant event," he told 200 Marines at one session in Al-Asad. "That said, there are some assholes in the world that just need to be shot. There are hunters and there are victims. By your discipline, cunning, obedience, and alertness, you will decide if you are a hunter or a victim. It's really a hell of a lot of fun. You're going to have a blast out here." He finished in Patton-esque fashion, "I feel sorry for every son of a bitch that doesn't get to serve with you." Small, slight, and bespectacled, Mattis didn't fit the Hollywood image of the fire-breathing Marine commander. But retired Marine Colonel Gary Anderson, himself a widely respected officer, commented, "I think he's the finest combat leader we've produced since Korea." Just before Christmas 2003 in California, preparing to take his troops back into Iraq, where they would relieve the 82nd Airborne in Al-Anbar Province, he held a two-day meeting of his staff and commanders at Camp Pendleton to plan a different approach. Mattis's Marines would be culturally sensitive, the group decided. They wouldn't wear sunglasses when interacting with Iraqis, so there wouldn't be a barrier between them and the locals. They would learn a smattering of Arabic. They would even grow mustaches, so they would look more like the locals. Marine intelligence analysts wouldn't overreact to clerics' Friday sermons blasting the occupiers. "Religious leaders are normally going to be critical publicly of the coalition," said a summary of the meeting's major points. "Otherwise, they will be seen as weak by their followers." Also, Marine commanders were warned to brace for Fridays when Iraqis left the mosques fired up. Most controversial, at least inside the U.S. military, were the steps the Marines chose to underscore to Iraqis that they weren't the U.S. Army. To emphasize to Iraqis that the Marines arriving in Fallujah and other centers of resistance were a new and different organization, the Marines planned to wear green camouflage uniforms and black Marine boots for their initial 45 days of patrolling, instead of the tan desert uniform worn by Army soldiers in Iraq. "The green uniforms will be one very visible difference, and symbolically represent that break between the old and the new," said one Marine officer who attended the Pendleton discussion. It was important to do so, he continued, because of the counterproductive approach some Army divisions had taken in 2003. I'm appalled at the current heavy-handed use of air and artillery in Iraq. I don't believe there is any viable use for artillery or JDAMs, joint direct attack munitions, precision-guided bombs weighing 1,000 or 2,000 pounds, in the current environment. This officer, like many Marines, had concluded that success in a counterinsurgency environment is based on winning popular support, not on blowing up people's houses. This generally softer, more culturally sensitive approach, combined with a hard-nosed willingness to mix it up when necessary, got good reviews from some others. The Marines are onto something here, said a Defense Intelligence Agency analyst with experience in Iraq. I like the Marine approach, and I think it'll succeed, said Lieutenant Colonel David Poirier, the MP commander in Tikrit who had been appalled by some of the actions of Army soldiers, especially the 82nd Airborne, when he operated in Fallujah. I believe that some of the insurgency is due to families acting out against American forces for deaths occurring as a result of collateral damage. But the express intention of the Marines to distinguish themselves from the Army drew angry responses from many others. Retired Army Colonel Lloyd Matthews said he found this aspect of the Marine discussions distasteful. It is hardly advisable in joint operations to denigrate the tactics of the sister service that preceded you in the trenches, and to suggest that you are going to do a lot better, he said. If one is going to do better than his predecessor, it is wiser to wait and let his success speak for itself, rather than trumpeting it in advance. He was especially unhappy with the intention to wear a different uniform. The green cami phase is for no other purpose than to differentiate the lovable Marines now in town from those detestable Army ruffians who just left. Others warned that the Marines were in for a rude surprise. Lieutenant Colonel John Gentile, who served with the 4th Infantry Division in the area around Tikrit, commented at the same time, "Unfortunately, the Sunni Triangle is nothing like southern Iraq or the part of northern Iraq around Mosul. I hope the Marines' velvet glove works, that it saves the lives of Marines and Iraqis and leads to a stable and secure region. But I also fear that this approach, by dismissing the cultural and tactical differences in the Sunni Triangle, will ignore the hard-won gains of Army units over the past 8 months." An Army general who was experienced in Iraq privately applauded the Marines' intentions, but quietly cautioned, "I don't think it will prove as easy as it briefs. Some of this reflects a degree of intellectual smugness that might be warranted after, say, 6 successful months on the ground." He would prove clairvoyant. When Mattis arrived in Iraq, Major General Swanick, the 82nd Airborne's commander, told him he had 3 pressing concerns about the Marines' contemplated approach. First, he said, "You guys need artillery. After seeing how we got mortared and rocketed in the evening, they decided to bring it," Swanick recalled. Second, he advised them to think twice about trying to institute the Marine Combined Action Platoon program. "I told them that the CAP program wouldn't work, that Al-Anbar province wasn't ready for it then, and maybe never, because they didn't want us downtown." Third, he vigorously objected to the Marine plan to wear green uniforms and black boots. "I told them that was a personal affront to me, and that a relief should be seamless," Swanick said. Mattis deferred to Swanick on the uniform issue, not wanting to cause a breach. "What I was trying to do was break the cycle of violence. He took it personally. I appreciated his candor." Mattis also maintained that he wasn't replicating the Vietnam-era CAP program, but adapting it, successfully in his view, to local cultural conditions. Each battalion would have 1 platoon that was given a 30-day course in Arab customs and language, and that unit in turn could help teach its company, and then the company could affect the entire battalion. Swanick thought he had done well in Fallujah. "I think Fallujah was being managed appropriately, with surgical operations based on precise intelligence," he said. Yet elsewhere in the U.S. military, there was a growing belief that the 82nd Airborne had lost control of the city. Abizade and Sanchez had been pressuring Swanick to do more about Fallujah, said an Army officer familiar with those exchanges. Mattis had a plan to handle the city. "I knew Fallujah would be tough," he recalled, "but he thought he could prevail through combining high-profile infrastructure projects, especially on electricity and water, with low-profile raids against specific individuals. We were going to use the softer forms, focus on lights and water, and go in with small teams to kill the bad guys at night. But, as it turned out, he would never get the chance to implement this approach. Instead, Fallujah went off the tracks almost immediately. In the view of some Marine officers, what would follow was a tragedy, beginning with a mistake and followed by death and retribution. Mattis's plan for Fallujah would become, for the Corps' commanders, a great lost opportunity, yet another of the many roads not taken. Marine commanders found that their broader plan for the pacification of Anbar province would be undercut by the chronic lack of troops. Colonel Tulin, commander of the 1st Marines, recalled that he had four basic missions: control major supply routes, MSR, develop Iraqi security forces, ISF, eliminate insurgent sanctuaries, and create jobs. The challenge was, when we controlled the MSRs and developed the ISF, there was no one left to eliminate sanctuaries or create jobs, so it was like whack-a-mole. And so, within weeks of arriving, the Marine Corps, which had wanted to go back to show how to work better with the people, would wind up instead involved in some of the most savage fighting U.S. troops had experienced in decades. Chapter 15. The Surprise. Spring, 2004. By the late winter of 2003 through 4, it was clear that the U.S. effort, both in pacification and reconstruction, was faltering. But it wouldn't be until spring that it would become clear just how troubled it was. The key change in the disposition of forces was a major rotation that withdrew the units that had been there a year and replaced them with a new set of divisions. Notably, this rotation cut the U.S. troop presence in the north, replacing the 101st Airborne, which, along with its attached units, had fielded 20,000 troops, with a patched-together outfit called Task Force Olympia that had less than half that number, and also far less mobility than the helicopter-rich 101st. One reason such a reduction was still thought possible was that midwinter had gone by quietly, perhaps lulling commanders, especially those who thought that the capture of Saddam Hussein in mid-December would quell the enthusiasm of the insurgents. And February 2004 brought the lowest death toll so far of any month during the U.S. military presence in Iraq, just 20, and a relatively peaceful fraction of the number in every subsequent month of that year. It was also the low point in terms of total U.S. troop presence in the country in 2003 through 5, dipping briefly to about 110,000. For the next 22 months, the number of U.S. troops would creep upward until finally, by the end of 2005, it hit 159,000, the highest level since the occupation began. The troop rotation itself may also have contributed to the misplaced sense of calm, as many experienced U.S. units began disengaging, doing less patrolling and more packing up. So, in retrospect, this period of quiet wasn't necessarily as reassuring as it was interpreted to be at the time. The insurgency was quiet in order to lay the groundwork for a spring offensive, a security expert who worked in the Green Zone said later. I think enemy forces were planning, solidifying their support base, getting ready to hit us in the spring. I was talking to Iraqis and they were saying things were going to get bad. We got intelligence that they were going to hit the Spanish and Italians, drive them out. That was the model. Isolate the U.S., then drive us out and embarrass us. U.S. forces learned, but then went home, while the enemy learned, and, if he survived, fought better the next time. In 2003, one ill-conceived drive-by shooting was conducted from a horse-pulled cart, remembered Colonel Teddy Spain. The Iraqi police, who had come under attack, simply shot the trotting horse and then finished off the stranded attackers. The insurgents grew more proficient with the passage of time, noted Ahmed Hashim, a professor of strategic studies at the U.S. Naval War College, who, as a reservist, would later serve with the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment. American forces had killed most of the incompetent ones. The tactics, techniques, and procedures of the surviving insurgents became more lethal as a result of experience. This change became apparent early in 2004, when the insurgents began to contend with fresh U.S. troops. Some disruption had been expected from the troop rotation, but commanders thought they could ensure that knowledge would be passed on. Yet the change seems to have given the insurgency a major opening. The new troops had two strikes against them. In a culture where social life turns not on official positions, but on personal relationships, they were blank slates. And with a fast and constantly moving insurgency, where the enemy was quickly adapting as well as operating on his own turf, anything that can be distilled into written knowledge is already likely to be a bit too old, a bit stale. The cutting edge of operations against an insurgency is the gut instinct that tells a squad leader that a street scene that appears safe really isn't, or the backlog of experience that allows a battalion commander to discern a new twist in what a sheik is telling him. Much of that was lost when new troops rotated in. They were enthusiastic and hard-working, but alien in the situation, while the other side had just gone through months of hard fighting. An Army War College study later arrived at this conclusion. Rotating nearly the entire force at once degraded capability, and that may have contributed to loss of control over several cities in the Sunni Triangle, wrote the Iraq Stabilization Study Team, a group at the college's Strategic Studies Institute that has produced some of the military establishment's most insightful work on the Iraq War. This wasn't just a theoretical problem about the loss of abstract data, but rather an urgent issue that involved the deaths of U.S. troops and Iraqi allies. On top of that, the radical reduction in U.S. troops in Mosul and elsewhere in the north began to have a corrosive effect on Iraqi security forces. The replacement units were less engaged with local security forces than the 101st had been, according to people who observed its operations. Police officials who had been visited daily were now seen only weekly or monthly. When you only have contact with them once a week, once every 2 weeks, a police chief begins to feel isolated and more likely to cut a deal with the insurgents, noted the 101st's Colonel Joe Anderson. The cutback in the U.S. presence in the north was even more severe in smaller towns. As the troop contingent in Tal Afar was reduced from 3,000 to about 500, friction between Sunnis and Shiites there increased. But the inaccurate U.S. assessment of the situation wasn't attributable solely to the rotation. The 82nd Airborne had been operating in Al-Anbar province for over 6 months when its commander incorrectly declared the insurgency all but dead there. The enemy was in disarray, he told reporters on March 10, just weeks before the province erupted. When we first got here, I felt very, very strongly about fighting the insurgency, and there was a very sophisticated insurgency here. Since then, he said, the army had successfully deprived it of its leadership, financing, and support structure. And so that's why I'm discounting a very serious insurgency ongoing here right now, because of those factors. In fact, Iraq was on the precipice of some of the worst fighting it would see during the entire U.S. occupation. Iraqis had never been particularly welcoming of the U.S. presence. But in the spring of 2004, some Americans were noticing a subtle shift in the reception they received. The real way that you could tell the frustration was growing was when you drove around the city and saw how people would respond to the Humvees, recalled Lieutenant A. Heather Coyne, an Arabic-speaking Army reservist who, unusually, joined the Army Reserve while working on terrorism issues in the White House's budget office. She served in the Army in Iraq for over a year, from the beginning of the occupation until the end of the CPA in June 2004. After a while, they would wave a little tentatively. After that, they would watch the Humvees with suspicion or concern, but they still waved back when I waved to them. Right toward the end, nobody was waving. The numbers in the CPA's own polls bore out Coyne's sense of decline. Late in 2003, the U.S. effort still had the benefit of the doubt of the broad Iraqi middle. the group that U.S. commanders would come to call the fence sitters. But the support dwindled steadily as the occupation wore on without producing either the security or the services it promised. In November 2003, according to a survey conducted for the CPA, nearly half of Iraqis polled, some 47%, expressed confidence in the CPA. By March 2004, it was down to just 14%. There was no security for Iraqis under the occupation, and that antagonized them, said Hallenbeck. People would read about every U.S. troop who dies, but we never heard about all the kidnappings, robbings, rapes of Iraqis. The average housewife was just terrified, and we didn't get that. There has been much subsequent hand-wringing about the CPA's lack of strategic communication with the Iraqi people, Hallenbeck said. But, he continued, the CPA communicated some points all too well, if unconsciously. The Green Zone had security, it had services, it had the things that Iraqis wanted. A lot of people had no electricity, but could look across the river and see the CPA all lit up at night, and that was the way we really communicated. In the fall and winter of 2003 through 4, he witnessed Iraqis beginning to turn against the occupation. I remember watching that turn. Iraqis were saying, not only do I not like these guys, they can't do anything for me, and they step on my dignity. The U.S. military fared no better in terms of winning hearts and minds. In November, only 11% of respondents had said they would feel safer if the U.S. forces left Iraq immediately. By January 2004, that figure had more than doubled to 28%. By April 2004, it would be 55%. As the pollsters put it in analyzing what they termed this substantial deterioration of image, Iraqis had come to see the U.S. military as part of the problem, a liability whose presence makes things more dangerous. By early 2004, we begin to smell like losers in Iraq, said analyst Patrick Clausen, because we can't deliver on personal security for Iraqis. There were robberies, kidnappings, carjackings. At that point, the military brass and the CPA were still pretty clueless. Then, Fallujah blew. It was a bad time. Major General Paul Eaton, who oversaw the training of Iraqi forces at that time, recalled, "This thing evolved in front of us, and each day it got incrementally worse until it exploded in late March." On Wednesday, March 24, the Army's 82nd Airborne turned over responsibility for Fallujah to the Marine Corps. Under the 82nd, Fallujah had been relatively quiet, in part because the 82nd had trod lightly in the city, not conducting intrusive patrols. John Abizade had said to me in November 2003 that we didn't want Fallujah to become a flashpoint, recalled General Swanick. Under the Marines, he pointedly noted, it did. The Marine view is different. Fallujah looked good, said Tulin, who commanded the 1st Marines, based just outside the city. It had a mayor, a police chief, all the trimmings. But it had termites. You always tread lightly, talking about the guys before you. But they, the 82nd Airborne, weren't out enough to do the termite inspections. He also was shocked during the turnover of command, when the army convoy he was in just pushed through an ambush outside the mayor's office, rather than launch a determined counterattack. If my guys did that, I'd have their ass. By Friday, just 3 days into Marine control, the city erupted. A group from Task Force 626, a successor to earlier elite organizations dedicated to killing or capturing high-level officials from the old regime, was hit by a bomb. Marine patrols into the city then engaged in a 36-hour-long series of firefights that left at least 15 Iraqis dead. The Marines were looking to engage both the people and the enemy, the first with friendship, the second with guns. "You want the fuckers to have a safe haven?" asked Lethen, the 1st Marine Division's operations officer, "or do you want to stir them up and get them out in the open?" But the Marine plan for Fallujah was thrown off track, irretrievably, by what happened next. Marine patrols into Fallujah were familiarizing themselves with the city, and in the process purposely stirring up the situation. Inside the city, insurgents were preparing to respond, warning shops to close and setting up roadblocks and ambushes with parked cars. 1 week into this new, more volatile situation, two SUVs carrying security contractors from a company called Blackwater bypassed a Marine checkpoint and drove into the Hornet's Nest, not understanding that the American approach to the city had changed and that it was in turmoil over the recent shootings. Just why the contractors were heading into the unsettled city is unclear, but there is little question about what happened next. The Blackwater vehicles ran into a well-prepared ambush that had been set up the day before. There had been a leak out of the Green Zone about their movements, said a senior U.S. intelligence official with direct access to that information. That morning, nearby shops were warned to close, and roadblocks were set up to prevent the contractors from escaping, according to a Marine briefing that summarized the events of this period. Cans of gas were stashed and standing ready in a nearby alley. The four American contractors were attacked near the center of town, hit by fire from AK-47s and RPGs. They were dragged from their car, beaten, and dismembered. Two of their torsos were dragged westward and hung from the girders of a bridge over the Euphrates on the edge of town, then taken down and tossed on a pile of tires to burn while crowds cheered and crowed. At the Marine headquarters outside Fallujah, senior commanders learned about the Blackwater situation from CNN. Mattis saw the attack as a ploy designed to provoke a massive retaliation. He devised a methodical plan to respond to the atrocity. If the Marines took it step by step, the ringleaders would be arrested or killed over the course of the next month, Francis Bing West, the author and former Pentagon official who was embedded with Marine commanders, wrote in No True Glory, his lively history of Marine operations in Al-Anbar in 2004. But the televised atrocity in Fallujah provoked a powerful response down the chain of command, starting from Washington, where the images of Muslim mobs burning Americans evoked memories of October 1993 in Mogadishu, Somalia. The civilian leadership of the U.S. government didn't want to wait for a careful, quiet counterattack. Robert Blackwell, who had been brought into the NSC staff to advise on Iraq policy, began pushing for a swift and tough retaliatory raid, according to officials who worked with him. That would knock the Marines off the course they'd planned, and top military commanders in Iraq, including Lieutenant General Sanchez, advised against it, said several people involved in the exchanges. Bremer was somewhere in the middle, said a former Bush administration official. Bremer asked for time to try to deal with the situation, he said, but the word came back from the White House. If there was no political movement, the president wanted action within a few days. Bremer talked to Sanchez about launching a vigorous attack, and soon the Marines got a call from Sanchez's headquarters. "Go in and clobber people," was the way one officer remembered it. Conway, the senior Marine in Iraq, wanted to hear the order from Abizaid, who told him the order had come from high up, that is, either Rumsfeld or the White House. "This is what the enemy wants," Mattis protested. He had been preparing to take Fallujah for months, but didn't want to do it this way, hastily, clumsily, acting in anger rather than with cool detachment. He was ordered, nonetheless, to get into Fallujah within 72 hours. He requested to see that order in writing, but didn't get it. Mattis wanted to do a police operation. Let's find out who did this and get them. "This is a city of 300,000 in which a few hundred people did something," said another Marine general. The answer was, "No, go in there with the power of a Marine division." He argued against this. What would be the consequences of doing this? Mattis knew that the consequence of sending in a big conventional unit inevitably would be large amounts of damage. Nor was a sudden movement a militarily effective way to operate. As a summary by retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel Frank Hoffman put it, the Marines were ordered to attack without time to insert human intelligence assets or sensors, conduct formal reconnaissance, add reinforcements, or shape the battle space. Conway, the senior Marine commander, later publicly said that he objected to how the attack on Fallujah was ordered. "We felt like we had a method that we wanted to apply to Fallujah. that we ought to probably let the situation settle before we appeared to be attacking out of revenge, he said as he prepared to leave Iraq a few months later. Would our system have been better? Would we have been able to bring over the people of Fallujah with our methods? You'll never know that for sure, but at the time we certainly thought so. He wouldn't tell reporters where the attack order originated, only that he received it from Sanchez. We follow our orders, Conway said. So, on April 5, the Marines launched Operation Vigilant Resolve. Almost exactly a year after the fall of Baghdad, the U.S. military was again engaged in a major offensive. First, small teams of special operators went in to try to capture high-value targets, according to the Marine summary. Next came a full-scale assault, carried out by about 2,500 Marines from three battalions, backed up by some tanks and other armored vehicles. It quickly became a grinding, toe-to-toe fight. The enemy was better prepared than the Marines had been told to expect. Insurgents surprised U.S. with coordination of their attacks, coordinated, combined, volley-fire RPGs, effective use of indirect fire, the Marine summary states. Enemy maneuvered effectively and stood and fought. Over the course of several weeks, the intense fighting was occasionally interrupted by either ceasefires or agreements that broke down, and was followed by a new round of airstrikes and the use of AC-130 gunships and Cobra gunship helicopters. In order to seal off the estimated 1,200 fighters inside Fallujah, Mattis asked for more troops, the Army's Theater Operational Reserve, and was turned down, Lethen recalled. So, he said, Mattis stripped out troops from elsewhere in Anbar. We thinned out our forces in the west and turned over part of our southeastern sector to the Army to concentrate our forces on Fallujah. One of the results, said Tulin, was that the Iraqi National Guard commander in the town of Mahmoudiya, on the main highway south of both Fallujah and Baghdad, went over to the dark side and wouldn't train his people anymore. Mattis also requested that he be given another regiment of several thousand Marines, plus a tank unit, according to a Marine officer. It isn't clear where that request died in the chain of command, but the fact that he asked and didn't get them casts doubt on the Bush administration's repeated insistence that senior commanders would get more troops any time they asked for them. As Fallujah ground on in early April 2004, and the fighting spread to nearby Ramadi, the broad middle of Iraq, from Mosul in the north to Baghdad in the middle to Najaf in the south-central area, began to spin out of control. On April 9, 2004, Bruce Hoffman, a RAND Corporation terrorism expert who had been consulting at the CPA, was leaving the country at the end of a four-week visit. We had three incidents on the way to Baghdad's airport, and then heard a huge explosion while we were there. It was the attack on the convoy that got Thomas Hamill. Hamill was a truck driver taken captive in one of the worst incidents involving contractors of the entire war. A 26-vehicle convoy bringing an emergency shipment of jet fuel from the big U.S. base at Balad to the Baghdad airport was ambushed 5 miles short of its destination. PFC Jeremy Church, a National Guardsman who was a Walmart security guard in civilian life, was driving for the convoy commander, Lieutenant Matt Brown, when he noticed that all the Iraqi cars and trucks on the highway had disappeared, leaving the Americans alone after what had been heavy traffic. A moment later, a fusillade of small arms fire hit the convoy, including a bullet that knocked Brown's helmet from his head. Brown's left eye popped out of its socket, and his brain began to bleed and swell. A bomb blew out a tire in the truck, but Church drove on the bare rim until he came to a base operated by a unit of the 1st Cavalry Division. He then helped organize a relief column to head back into the kill zone to rescue the survivors of the ambushed convoy, an act for which he received the Silver Star. Six drivers had been killed, some by rocket-propelled grenades, others by small arms fire, and others apparently by flames. Huge plumes of black smoke were visible for miles. Two Army soldiers on escort duty were also killed, and one was taken captive. Around this time, Dan Saner, Bremer's spokesman, vowed at a Green Zone press conference We will not allow this country to head down the path toward destabilization. But even as he said it, it seemed like that was precisely the course Iraq was on. It was an unusual press conference, conducted in a big, formal meeting room, upholstered with an orange carpet, and featuring a soldier in battle fatigues and body armor, carrying an automatic weapon and surveying the assembled reporters. In addition to Fallujah and Ramadi, the U.S.-led coalition lost any semblance of authority in several other south-central cities, most notably in Najaf and Kut. The ability of armed U.S. forces to operate routinely in much of the rest of central Iraq diminished. The major difference from the previous 9 months or so of fighting was that for the first time, even as the Sunnis were fighting in Fallujah and Ramadi, a Shiite militia was attacking across a broad area. The forces of Muqtadir al-Sadr, a rabble-rousing radical Shiite cleric who strongly opposed the U.S. presence, would take a different approach than the Sunnis, who had been doing the bulk of the fighting for many months. Just 30 years old, Sadr was the son of Grand Ayatollah Muhammad Sadiq Sadr, who had been assassinated along with two of his sons in Najaf in 1999, presumably on the order of Saddam Hussein. Sadr puzzled U.S. officials, who judged him an awkward, unintelligent young man who, they calculated, could be neglected into obscurity. That view tended to underestimate the power that Sadr's populist strain of Shiism derived from nationalist sentiments. Unusually for a Shiite, Sadr's posters tended to feature the Iraqi flag,